Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
From WNYC Studios, I'm Brian Lehrer. This is my Daily Politics Podcast. It's Wednesday, April 3rd. Well, you've been hearing about the killing in Gaza of seven humanitarian aid workers delivering food from the World Central Kitchen Relief Organization, founded by Chef Jose Andres. As it happened, Chef Andres was just on this show 2 weeks ago on March 19th.
The important number is that World Central Kitchen has done 37 million meals. We have more than 66 kitchens. We do around 250,000 hot meals for a total of around 350,000 meals a day.
350,000 meals a day now gone for the foreseeable future. Chef Jose Andres on this show last month, and he said it is very complicated to bring food into Gaza. Listen.
So it's a very complicated process to bring food into Gaza, where the food and the humanitarian aid keeps changing tracks and then has to be checked by Israel and then again changes tracks again.
And Chef Andre said the easiest place to get food into had been the south in the Rafah area. It was harder as they moved up to the middle and north of the Gaza Strip.
They can be blockades in the middle by people are hungry. So even when you are succeeding because you are feeding people, the issue is that you are not succeeding in reaching the hospitals or the communities very, very north all the way to Jabalia that they are having a hard time finding food.
Chef Andres on the show last month, and they have now suspended their deliveries while they reassess the safety situation. Those numbers that he gave us in the first clip from last month indicate the impact the suspension will have on the amount of food Gazans can find. 350,000 meals a day is what he said they were delivering. The dead in this incident are reported to include three British citizens, one Polish national, one Australian, one Canadian-American, and one Palestinian. Chef Andres has a New York Times op-ed today that begins by naming the names of his seven dead colleagues. We will respect that and repeat those. Saifeddin Issam Ayad Abu Taha, John Chapman, Jacob Flickinger, Zomi Frankom, James Henderson, James Kirby, and Damian Sobel. Chef Andres writes that they risked everything for the most fundamentally human activity to share our food with others. So how did this happen? The Israeli newspaper Haaretz quotes sources from the IDF, the Israeli Defense Forces, who say a drone bombed the World Central Kitchen aid convoy three times, targeting an armed Hamas member who wasn't there. That from Haaretz. And it continues that IDF sources also told Haaretz that the aid workers were killed because officers on the ground do what they want. This also comes as President Biden has been increasingly critical of Israel's war efforts in public comments, though, as you know, he continues to supply military aid with no consequences for what he condemns. And it comes as Haaretz reports that protesters in the thousands, including family members of hostages, were demonstrating last night in front of the Knesset, the Israeli parliament, demanding immediate elections. And they report police clashed with hostages' families as hundreds protested outside Prime Minister Netanyahu's home. So we'll talk now to Haaretz journalist Allison Kaplan-Summer. She's also the host of the Haaretz weekly podcast and co-host of their podcast called The Promised. And she has an article now called If Only Israel Thought of All Its Gaza Victims as a PR Disaster. Allison, thank you for giving us some time at this ongoing intense time in your country. Welcome to WNYC.
Thank you so much for having me on.
You report that the death of these aid workers is not being treated with what you call the usual Israeli reaction. What would that usual reaction be, and what's the difference that you're seeing?
Well, typically there's a very cautious attitude towards assigning blame, towards taking responsibility immediately. and saying that Israel has to watch and wait, and it's not taking responsibility. There's often insinuations that the victims of these humanitarian disasters had some sort of role in their fate. That, for example, when there was a run on humanitarian aid, that there was some sort of Hamas involvement in the distribution of aid. There are definitely a lot of hesitations before the military will take responsibility. They rarely express deep condolences, a sense of a deep regret for what's happened. And I think because of the sense that this is indeed a public relations disaster, that World Central Kitchen really had unprecedented level of cooperation with the IDF, that this was such a mistake on such large proportions and involved citizens of countries on whose support that Israel relies, that a very different tone was struck this time than we've seen in the past, unfortunately, with multiple IDF, I don't want to say mishaps, but mistakes and tragic miscalculations that have caused thousands and thousands of lives.
So to your headline, if only Israel thought of all its Gaza victims as a PR disaster, how would you fill in that scenario? What if Israel thought all of its Gaza victims, meaning the innocent civilians who they're killing in the course of the war, were PR disasters for them? What do you think might be different?
Well, maybe we would see lower numbers of Palestinians killed. There is great support for the need. There was great support for the need after October 7th for Israel to take military action so that this would not happen again, in order to make its borders safe for its southern communities. The country was in deep trauma over what had happened. In a very similar way, I think, to the United States reaction to 9/11, there was an emotional sense that we had to go in there and hit as hard as we could in order to protect the country. And I think that, you know, in that atmosphere, in that sense, that there has been a hardening of Israeli hearts in view of the horrible atrocities that occurred on October 7th to the humanitarian crisis happening in Gaza as a result of what's going on in terms of the Israeli offensive there. There's agreement that there's a need to disarm Hamas militarily, but I don't think there's been quite enough sensitivity as to the human cost and not enough public sensitivity shown by the military leaders and the Israeli political leaders as to what's happening there and the cost.
I read a stat on Vox that 196 aid workers have been killed in this war. If that's true, and tell me if you have reporting at Haaretz that backs that up or not, why do you think none of those other 189 aid worker deaths created this kind of PR disaster?
I don't know if that precise number is true. Given the overall numbers of civilians killed, I wouldn't be surprised. When we talk about those humanitarian workers, I think, you know, we're talking about a lot of the UNRWA workers, and I think that Israel has not been coordinating as closely with those organizations as they have with the World Central Kitchen, which, you know, really had the close endorsement of the Israeli military and was working closer with them. On the other side of the argument, there is the Hamas strategy, especially in the beginning of the war, but even now, of prosecuting its war from underground tunnels and putting itself inside hospitals, inside places where civilians come for humanitarian aid. So there's a direct conflict between the Israeli military's determination to root out the Hamas military infrastructure and a desire to mitigate civilian casualties. It's a direct conflict. If you find that the places where the infrastructure is located is in the midst of places where civilians are gathering in order to get humanitarian aid.
You mentioned Hamas, and they are, of course, the other part of the equation. And I see that your Haaretz colleague, Amira Haas, who reports from the West Bank, and has lived previously in Gaza, has a story this week called "People Are Constantly Cursing Sinwar." Sinwar is the leader of Hamas. "People are constantly cursing Sinwar. Gazans opposing Hamas are sure they're the majority." Can you offer any insight on whether people in Gaza, even as they obviously hate what Israel is doing to them directly, also want to be done with Hamas or blame them for putting them in this position with October 7th and by embedding among civilians as they do?
Well, unfortunately, when you've got a violent military terrorist dictatorship, you can't really conduct great public opinion polls. Amira, who communicates a great deal with people in Gaza, says that there is that sense. And there have been videos circulated around social media of people chanting against Sinwar, against Hamas. But those of my colleagues, Amira is one of them, but we have many people at Haaretz who are in communication with Gazans, although they're not there necessarily on the ground right now, but through telephone and through the limited amount of internet they can get there. There may be some sentiment against Hamas, but there's a lot more, I think, resentment against Israel, which is actually perpetrating the violence that they're suffering from.
Do Israelis at all resent the fact that Israel seems to be playing right into Hamas's hands, even as it seeks to destroy Hamas? Tell me if you accept this narrative, but by many accounts that I've seen, Hamas went big on October 7th, seeking to draw just this kind of massive Israeli response that would be a PR disaster for Israel, launch a wider war, and stop Saudi Arabia from normalizing relations, which was on the table. Would you say it's a consensus position that that's what Hamas was after, or that Hamas is winning in those respects as Israel takes the bait, hook, line, and sinker?
Well, I think there's a sense that Hamas won on October 7th by, defying all of the assumptions, they call it the concept that Israel could pacify Hamas, which really wanted to be a state taking care of its people, and that if we gave it enough power, enough control, funneled enough cash through Qatar, that we could guarantee a limited amount of violence across the border, and obviously a great deal of faith in the high-tech solutions that were happening across the Gaza border. And all of those conceptions collapsed on the heads of Israelis on October 7th, and they were devastated to feel that. And yes, I think the two things are true. One is that Israelis do believe that they played into the hands of Hamas. At the same time, I don't think that they saw an alternative, that they believe that they live in a rough and difficult neighborhood in the middle of the Middle East. And if someone does to you what Hamas did on October 7th, and you sit back, and especially with the taking the hostages, you can't sit back and not give a very a strong response, because not only will that enable and embolden Hamas and increase their sense of victory, but it will enable and embolden other enemies, and they will say, wow, if Hamas got away with that kind of attack, let's see what we can do. And there's a strong sense of necessary deterrence on the northern border and on the other border. So I think that, yes, Israelis may agree that Israel played into Hamas's hands, but I don't think they quite see what the alternative to doing so would have been.
And I will tell you, Allison, and my guest is Haaretz journalist Allison Kaplan Summer, joining us from Israel, that we have a number of callers and a number of people texting who are alleging the same thing, that this was not a mistake. This was a purposeful attack on the aid workers because they were aid workers. Are you hearing many people allege that? And is there evidence one way or the other?
I'm not hearing people allege that. Even Haaretz's reporting is that there was an armed man who was with this convoy that was accompanying the humanitarian aid. And a division inside the army decided that this was a suspected Hamas terrorist, and that targeting this one armed man apparently was worth the risk of killing these seven aid workers. I honestly don't see where any Israeli interest lies in attacking humanitarian aid workers, Brian. And this is the reason, aside from the fact that it's immoral and horrific. And I wouldn't want to think that anyone In any army would want to directly target humanitarian aid workers, but it's against Israel's own interests, because if the World Central Kitchen employees are killed, as they were, and the reaction is what the reaction has been, which is for World Central Kitchen to withdraw and stop feeding people in Gaza, if the humanitarian organizations, which again, the IDF has been closely cooperating with, aren't distributing the aid, then who distributes the aid? Israel certainly doesn't want Hamas distributing the aid. That's what began to happen a few months ago, and I think was the impetus for helping these humanitarian organizations, international organizations, come in, like the World Central Kitchen. If Hamas doesn't distribute the aid and the humanitarian organizations don't distribute the aid, who's left holding the bag? It's Israel. Israel is going to essentially de facto have to be responsible for feeding and taking care of millions of Palestinians in Gaza, which is not something that I believe the Israeli population and the Israeli leadership wants to be responsible for. So I don't see orders having gone down from on high. Yes, please target these humanitarian aid workers.
Rabbi Eli in Lakewood, you're on WNYC. Hello, Rabbi. Thank you for calling in.
Yes, thank you for having me. Senator Rand Paul a few years ago had a hearing in the Senate floor about the Obama-Biden administration droning thousands of civilians, Pakistan, Afghanistan, Syria, and it seems that thousands of civilians were killed, and the Obama-Biden administration knew about it. They knew they were constantly killing civilians, and they kept pulling the trigger. That was their way of going after the terrorists. There were many situations where they made mistakes and they didn't even get the terrorists, and all they killed was civilians. They never apologized. They never came clean. This is a full-fledged war. It's a self-defense war. Every country in the world does exactly what Israel did. Every single country in the entire earth, including every single country that is doing this criticism, does the exact same thing and much, much, much worse.
Oh, I was just going to say the United States, I think, Biden in particular, takes the position that the U.S. did things wrong in some respects in Afghanistan and in Iraq, and trying to hold Israel to that standard.
He himself was involved in that. He ran for president on his record as the vice president who was involved in these foreign issues and taking down terrorism and protecting America. He ran for president on these issues. He's not apologizing. He, until today, is not apologizing. He's still refusing to come clean, and he's still standing by the various civilians that he killed. Every single country in the entire world at war does the exact same thing and 10 times worse, without exception. In every single war, without exception, there is no such a thing as war without such incidents taking place. There is absolutely no such a thing. It's not even possible.
Thank you for your call. We appreciate it. I don't have the stats from every single war or the knowledge to back up and say every single country would fight a war with those same standards. You're certainly hearing from, you know, these couple of callers, two out of the three callers who we've had so far, a continuing staunch defense of the way that this war is being fought. What's the conversation like in Israel?
I don't think that there's a lot of controversy over the way that the war is being fought. I think that, again, you have to understand the public sentiment of how much loss and devastation happened on October 7th, how much pain there still is over the hostages being held. I think Americans who are old enough to remember these things, if you basically can take the sentiments of Americans after 9/11 and fuse them with the sentiments of Americans during the Iranian hostage crisis, you know, you have to be a much older American to remember that, of the yellow ribbons and the constant reminders of the hostages. So this is a very emotional issue in Israel. So I think that, you know, the calls overseas for ceasefire or just stop it, or like, you know, Biden and other American leaders would like to just go away, the sentiments aren't here in Israel. But increasingly, and beginning of the war, there's not been tremendous faith in Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu to have the national interest at heart in the way that he's waging the war. I think there's a lot of doubt in Netanyahu personally. And I think the slogans that the politicians have been saying that we need to achieve total victory against Hamas. I think that there's increasing doubt that total victory is possible, and what will it look like? And there's deep uneasiness with the fact that none of the leaders in the current government in Netanyahu's coalition really have any idea of how this will end, any interest in it ending. And I think the concept of having any kind of swift war with a clear victory has now passed. And now there's concern that this is going to drag on for, obviously it's already dragged on for months, but perhaps years. So I think that there is definite support for the war continuing and being waged until there's some sort of two-pronged resolution. One is getting our hostages out, and the second is creating a situation in which the people in the border communities of Gaza who were evacuated from their homes can return and live in safety, that there's great support for military intervention continuing until those goals are achieved. But I think that there's increasing worry that there is no clear vision for the end game and what will happen the day after these hostilities stop.
Closing question. What would most Israelis say to the ultimate historical critique that is more centrally a part of the conversation at American colleges and elsewhere now more than in the past, that Israel as a Jewish state is and always was fundamentally unjust, that it was settler colonialism, because even though Israel was the Jews' ancient homeland and 2,000 years of persecution culminating in the Holocaust was very real, still, Jewish people came from other countries in the 20th century by the hundreds of thousands explicitly to create a state where they were officially in charge, even though the Palestinian Arabs even lived there, I mean already lived there, and are now disenfranchised. Do Israelis hear that being discussed more in American intellectual circles than it was in the past? Or maybe discussed openly more than it was in the past, and have any substantive response?
I mean, obviously, Israelis are very worldly and sophisticated. They're on the internet, they're on cable news, they're not unaware of those dialogues taking place on the campuses and elite campuses, and they obviously would disagree with some of those narratives. They would point out some of the factual errors and assumptions in it. First of all, the majority of Israelis are not originally European. They come from Africa. Many were expelled from Arab countries when the state of Israel was created. But the name calling, settler colonialism and colonialists, what's the solution to colonialism? That the people should go back to where they came from, to their original countries. Where should Jewish Israelis go back to? I think that would be that is the common Israeli response to it. Fine, you want to call me a colonizer? Where exactly do you suggest that I leave and return to? And obviously, it's most emotional and most vocal among the children and grandchildren of Holocaust survivors. There's a dwindling number of elderly Holocaust survivors themselves in response to that. So I think that there's a sense that a lot of this this rhetoric is based on limited information, if not misinformation, and obviously disagreeing with that narrative.
Thanks to our Israel-connected callers for calling in on this segment, and thanks to Haaretz journalist Allison Kaplan-Summer. She is also the host of the Haaretz weekly podcast and co-host of their podcast called The Promised. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Brian Lehrer, a daily politics podcast, is an excerpt from my live daily radio show, The Brian Lehrer Show, on WNYC Radio, 10 a.m. to noon Eastern Time, if you want to listen live at WNYC.org. Thanks for listening today. Talk to you next time.